Hey, it's Andrew, the Director of Literary Arts. Here at Literary Arts, we rely on our community, people like you, for support. To help make this podcast and all our programming possible, give today, literary-arts.org/donate. Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project is provided by Cole Haan. Cole Haan's shoes, bags, and outerwear go with you while you work your way to extraordinary. More at colehaan.com. This episode is part of an ongoing series featuring conversations curated and led by Oregon's Poet Laureate, Anis Majgani. Anis invited two writers to join him in conversation. Both are primarily poets, but have recently authored books of nonfiction about the intersection of American history, culture, and the African-American experience. Hanif Abdurraqib is the author of two full-length collections of poetry in addition to a chapbook. He is perhaps most well-known for Go Ahead in the Rain, Notes to a Tribe Called Quest, which was long-listed for the National Book Award and was a national bestseller. In this conversation, he's primarily talking about his most recent book, A Little Devil in America, Notes in Praise of Black Performance. Clint Smith is the author of the poetry collection Counting Descent and is a staff writer at The Atlantic. His new book is How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America, which will be published on June 1st. The conversation you are about to hear is special because it is among poets, and these poets bring to their subject an unusual perspective and surprising insights, insights we don't always get from traditional historians or cultural critics. Both Smith and Abdurraqib have published extensively on foundational or pivotal aspects of American history and culture, and their perspectives are vital to a national conversation we are having about race right now. Here's Oregon's Poet Laureate, Anis Majgani.
I'm curious about, you know, with both of you being poets, and also like writers that don't just write poetry, but being poets, what the process was with regards to creating books that are not poems, but are also very much rooted in language. I mean, I know, Hanif, you have talked in the past before about that relationship between writing poetry and writing nonfiction and how they're more or less one and the same. But like, you know, how does the poetic language help infer that which is, say, maybe removed from poetry? And also, Clint, you know, that like that there's, you know, you've written this book that is so heady, and yet it never feels as if it is too much for my head to hold. Sometimes it's too much for my heart to hold, but it's never too much for my head to hold. And that like littered throughout it, there are just like these like beautiful returns to just like these poetic moments that are so beautiful. And so I'm curious about like for both of you, what that process was of like creating these longer books of nonfiction with this poetic hands, as it were, that were holding them.
I'd love to hear from Clint first, because this is his first time doing it. I've done it before.
Yeah, this is Hanif's, this is what he does.
just answers this question.
This book began in earnest in 2017, in May, after the Confederate statues in New Orleans came down. So we had statues of P.G.T. Beauregard, a Confederate general and a slaveholder. We had statues of Jefferson Davis, president of the Confederacy, a slaveholder. Statue of Robert E. Lee, most powerful general in the Confederate Army, a slaveholder. And this battle, this statue to the Battle of Liberty Place, which was a Reconstruction era white insurrection attempt to overthrow the integrated government of Louisiana. And so these were the four statues that were coming down. And it, through politics and litigation, it was a sort of 2-year period after the Charleston massacre, which was the initial sort of catalyst for to have the city council and the mayor vote to take these statues down. And so after 2 years, in May 2017, they finally came down. And I had this moment where I was looking around the city and watching this statue of this man, this Robert E. Lee, on a 60-foot pedestal, coming down and thinking about how many times I had driven past that yeah. traffic circle, and how many times I had, you know, sometimes on the way to school, like every day, and what it meant that I was, that I had grown up in this majority Black city in which there were more homages and iconography to enslavers than there were enslaved people. And what are the implications of that? And how does that happen? Like, what is the history that creates a set of narratives that allows the placement of such symbolism to take place at all, right? And what does it mean that I went to a middle school named after a Confederate leader? What does it mean that my parents live on a street named after somebody who owned 150 enslaved people? What does it mean that to get to the grocery store, I had to go down Robert E. Lee Boulevard? To get to school, I had to go down Jefferson Davis Highway, and that it was everywhere, right? Like it's exactly. saturated in the city in these profound ways. And so I started thinking about that, and I started thinking about like how different places across the country were tackling that, running from that, or doing something in between. And I've been writing nonfiction for years now. I had been doing a lot of freelancing before I became a staff writer at The Atlantic. But I had never done a sort of book length treatment of nonfiction. My only previous book was a book of poetry, Counting Descent, 2016. And at first, when I started thinking about these questions, I was writing about them, or I was writing into them through poetry, right? Like the first, mm-hmm. even before I knew that this was going to be a book or a longer project, a lot of the questions and a lot of the poems that you all heard, you know, years before I even knew this would be a book, or at least even the early stages of trying to write and figure out what this was, were sort of poetic treatments of these questions, like wrestling with founding fathers and monuments to them, wrestling with what I was taught the Civil War was as compared to what the primary source documents demonstrate the Civil War was about, thinking about my own sort of personal relationship to this history and then how that fits into and is in conversation with this macro history. And at first I thought, okay, well, maybe I'll write a collection of poems and each poem will be about a particular monument in the city. And that'll be the sort of conceit. And then I started writing into that space, and I was like, something's not happening here that I need to be happening. And part of what I realized is that I didn't want this project to be in just my voice. I thought it needed a sort of longer treatment. And I also thought that like, even once it moved from a collection of potential poems to a collection of potential essays, it was much less interesting for me to write these extended meditations on how I felt about these Confederate monuments or how I felt about these memorials or how I felt about these historical sites. And I thought that the book became more rich when my own experiences and sensibilities and questions were put in conversation with that of others. And so I went to Monticello in 2018, and in the summer of 2018, and I went there and I was getting a tour of Monticello Plantation, for those who don't know, where Thomas Jefferson lived. And I was getting the Slavery at Monticello tour. And it was this really profound experience in which the tour guide was speaking directly to Thomas Jefferson's legacy as an enslaver, right? And kind of not making any qualms or having there be any sort of sidestepping around the fact that like Jefferson is both the person who wrote in one document, all men are created equal, and wrote in another document that Black people are inherently inferior to whites in both endowments of body and mind, that he wrote the Declaration of Independence, one of the most important documents in the history of the Western world, and that he owned over 600 enslaved people over the course of his lifetime, including four of his own children. And so I was struck by how direct it was. And I was also struck by how many people on the tour were encountering that information for the first time. And I think sometimes with the friends I have and circles I run in and the spaces I'm a part of, we can take for granted how different communities of folks are moving through the world with different sets of information. And so I was at Monticello and I was with these folks who were like, oh my gosh, like I had no idea that Jefferson owned enslaved people, right? They were like, I just came to see the house. I just thought we were gonna, yeah. And that was really revealing for me. And I was like, I have to talk to these people. And I'm not like, it's interesting because now the book is starting to, you know, come out and people are, I'm doing more media around it and people are like, poet and journalist, Clint Smith. And I'm like, who's a journalist? Like, I was like, journalist, who? That's a weird, I mean, I get it because I'm a staff writer for a journalistic outlet, but I've never thought of myself in that way. And so I think I'm still getting accustomed to it.
That's interesting. Like, you know, that's one of the things that strikes me about the book is how willing you are to engage with the reader and with the people that travel through the book, you know, it often feels as if like one of the things that holds so much of our progress at bay is just the immense wealth of pain and discomfort at having to like reckon with these things. And there's never a point that I felt, you know, and I recognize my lens might be reading the book differently through, of course, anybody else who might be reading, we're going to read it differently, but that like at no point in the book do I ever feel that anything in the book is coming from a place of retribution, of belittlement, of directing shame or ire towards a reader or to a people. While all those things are, you know, perhaps rightfully felt, you know? And so I think, you know, like truly that's where journalism comes into play and how we engage with the voices of many people to distill that towards many people. And you do that really, really beautifully through the book, I think. There's a grace there.
I appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, part of it is that I'm not a natural reporter, right? Like in the sense that like, I think there are some folks who are, you know, who are my colleagues at The Atlantic who can like walk up to strangers and ask them questions and it's like nothing. For me, walking up to strangers and asking them questions about the history of white supremacy, no less, is like, nah, that's not my general ethos. Like, that's not how I move through the world. But I knew that I had to do it. And when I did that, when I went, Monticello was the first place that I did that because I had written and I tell this to like high school students all the time, but I had written probably like 30,000 words and two or three of what I thought would be the first chapter before I got to Monticello. And it was all these sort of extended meditations. And I was like, nah, it's not hitting the way that I wanted to. And when I went up to this woman, Donna and Grace, after our tour and started having this conversation with them, I was like, this is what this book needs, right? Like it has to be conversations with these folks. And to your point, you know, for me, I'm not interested. I don't want this book to be a polemic. I don't want it to be didactic. I'm not interested in going in to try to shame or belittle people. I'm going in because I'm curious. I'm going in because the beauty of journalism at its best is that it pushes me to have discussions and conversations with people who I would otherwise never be in conversation with. And I think that that's so important. And I think that I never operate under the pretense of objectivity, right? Like I'm never going in and engaging these folks as if I don't have an opinion or my own sensibilities around this. Like I'm very clear with the reader about that. And I'm very clear with the people I'm in conversation with. And I think that that's almost what makes the book more interesting, right? Is that I'm not sitting here pretending like I don't have an opinion. I'm sitting here like, well, it's fascinating how this land can be the site of a wedding for you and the site of one of the happiest days of your life. And for me, this land represents something fundamentally different and is the site of torture and is a site of like intergenerational bondage and exploitation. So you know, part of what I try to do, whether I'm talking to folks at Monticello or the Sons of Confederate Veterans at the Blanford Cemetery in Virginia, is move with curiosity.
You know, and I think that that's like super, super important, like particularly with things of this nature, you know, like in your chapter where you're writing to slavery in New York City and your tour guide, Damaris Obi, she says, like, I think like at the end of y'all's tour, thank you for being uncomfortable with me. It struck me as such a like beautiful, wonderful sentence, you know, like for many reasons, you know, it's like one of the reasons why I love to perform is because it like gives me a space to be like comfortable in my uncomfortableness, you know, but also just, I think that it is so imperative for us to have these conversations about the truths of our country. And that like, it's not about having these conversations to like make someone feel bad. It's like having these conversations that are uncomfortable and we have to have that uncomfortable conversation so that like people don't keep dying, so that people don't keep being killed, so that people are able to like live their full liberation. And so it's like, we have to sit in those spaces of discomfort. And so much of this country is really fearful of that and really scared of that. And it can be something as simple as like, yo, let's sit in this space and just recognize it's going to not be comfortable for a period, you know? So like, I really appreciate that very, very much. Hanif, like, I know that you've talked about this a lot, but you know, one of the things that struck me when I was reading the book is, you know, that something would surface in one of the essays and one of the sections that would like suddenly hold weight. But then when I would kind of like think of like what it was, the book that I was reading and what like the purpose of the book is, the ethos of the book, like, you know, all of a sudden that phrasing or that language or that sentence, like, took on a whole different weight with relation back to like this idea of performance with blackness. And so I'm curious how much of the book is written with that in mind and how much of it is like, all right, I want to write about this. I want to write about Aretha Franklin's funeral. And while I'm writing about this, I'm also maybe going to like see if it is held under this similar light as perhaps this idea that I'm writing about, or versus how much of it was like, yeah, everything comes back to this thing that I'm speaking to right now.
I think it was a bit half and half. And some of that was because mm-hmm. I was trying to broaden my ideas of what performance was, to remove performance just from the stage and to seep it into a type of everyday Black American living, right? And so that means that even the performances that begin with stage things or begin with performers who are known for a stage thing, like a Josephine Baker, like Aretha Franklin, through my writing, because of that curiosity I was pursuing, these pieces still flowed back to the larger idea of how does performance affect and impact living. And so the piece about Aretha Franklin is more about Black funerals. Or the second, you know, I have those two back-to-back pieces on Aretha. The second piece is also kind of about funerals. It's also about like, how do we joyfully witness someone after they've gone, after they've left us? And it kind of all comes back to that. And so much of this wasn't deliberate picking, you know, where it's like, okay, today I'm going to work on the Soul Train essay. It was kind of witnessing and finding out things and then kind of running after them. I mean, the Magical Negro piece is a perfect example of this because it goes in so many different directions, but all of them felt vital to me.
I love that piece, by the way.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, that piece was
like, it's really wonderful.
It was fun to write. I mean, of you know, I think there's some place in the book where I got to be more playful. You know, that piece and the blackface piece where I got to kind of, I think, balance some humor or playfulness with a very non-playful topic. And I think that too was a part of me feeling some freedom that I hadn't maybe felt before, which is really me saying feeling some confidence in my voice that I hadn't felt before. Mm-hmm. The ability to be playful and funny while still making sure that people knew that I was writing about something I took very seriously.
You know, like one of the things that I really love about that piece, and one thing that jumped out to me was this thought of like ownership within Black community of an idea and trope like the Magical yeah. Negro, you know, which is a way that I had never like approached it or held that lilt before. And that kind of like runs through the book, this like constant tension of what are the ways in which, you know, like that performance is happening with Blackness and what is, you know, because there's always like something happening backstage, you know, with all of us. And I think particularly like here in this country, when it comes to race, like what is happening on one side of the curtain and what is happening on the other side of the curtain. And then also like who's in the audience, you know, and what is that equation of performance that's going on like, based on those three things.
Who in the audience understands what they're witnessing? I mean, I think all the time this piece was finished large before the Magical Negro piece specifically, but the whole book was finished before Queen's Gambit came out, right? And I read all this stuff about Queen's Gambit. I read all this praise about it. And in none of these reviews did anyone mention that show has a whole Magical Negro trope, like literally a Magical Negro trope, right? And then finally, yes. You know, a Black woman wrote about it, like a Black woman. And it, of course, it was a black person and a Black woman who wrote about it. But all the other reviewers and praisers who were not Black couldn't, it made me realize that, okay, I think maybe people actually don't understand this trope at all, or like what this trope is, or the history of it, which is why we still get folks being like, Stacey Abrams should be in a Marvel movie. It's like, well, you know, should Stacey Abrams be in a Marvel movie, or do you just not know how to interact with Black people doing anything?
There's this quote from the author of My Grandmother's Hands, Rizma Menken. I remember when I come across it, like sometime last year, it kind of like blew me away, just because of like how he speaks so directly to this, where he says, trauma decontextualized in a person looks like personality. Trauma decontextualized in a family looks like family traits, and trauma in a people looks like culture. And, you know, particularly with reading both these books at the same time, thinking about that relationship of grief and loss and trauma and how people are required to carry it and how it informs us, while also, like, you know, there's this tension, I think, of how trauma and grief informs us while also like wanting to move away from those things, to like feel like not being defined by that. Under the context of both these books, I'm curious about, you know, both of y'all's thoughts on that idea, that principle, I guess, of just like how we carry our grief. And so it shapes us, but also like how to not let it consume us, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in the context of my book, I thought a lot about that, because in some ways, what white supremacy does when you consider writing a book about slavery is make you wonder if you should write a book about slavery, right? Like, part of the insidiousness of a white supremacist anti-Black project in the American context is that it makes you feel like we talk about slavery all the time, and that slavery is this sort of omnipresent feature of American life and discourse in ways that it's actually not, right? And in ways that it like both makes you feel like we're talking about slavery all the time, even though we don't actually discuss slavery with the level of rigor and honesty that it is at all commensurate with the actual impact that it has had on the contemporary landscape of this country, right? And so it makes you think that, like, you know, I know about Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass, and I saw 12 Years a Slave, and like, you know, slavery is horrible. I get it. But like, we talk about that all the time, you know, in ways that we never do with other phenomena in this country. And so for me, part of what I wanted to do was to recognize, like, there was a recognition that over the past several years, I've been deeply engaged with, hence the nature of my like banter at poetry shows is like, so in 1619, and everybody in the venue is like, you know, I think they just came off a Sarah Kay poem, and then they're coming into Clint Smith's sort of interrogation of the project of enslavement in the United States. And part of what I wanted to do was say, like, I've been so steeped in the historiography of slavery, and I've been spending so much time with these scholars and thinkers who have written books on enslavement and really shaped my understanding of what the institution is and how it has impacted our country today and our world today. And I think there's still more to be said. Like, what can I contribute to this conversation and this literature that I'm not seeing, and that is unique to what I can offer? And so part of what I tried to do was think about, what does thinking about slavery with the conceit of place, like thinking of the history of slavery in specific places and how it manifests itself there in the people and in the land, and also bringing the sort of writing sensibilities of a poet, you know, and taking seriously the craft and taking seriously the literary landscape of the work, you know, in the sense that how can I bring sensory details or human texture and emotional texture to so much of this history that has been really profound in shaping my thinking? Like, not only, you know, how do you take a book like The Hemingses of Monticello that Annette Gordon Reed has written, one of the most remarkable books and forms of scholarship that I've ever read, and how do you say, like, well, what does it mean to take the history from that book and to go to Monticello and to like describe what it looks like what it feels like, what it sounds like, who the people there are, what their voices are like, what they look like, what does it feel like to stand inside of this slave cabin? What does it feel like to stand inside of this building constructed for a man who wrote about Phyllis Wheatley, the first published Black woman poet in the history of this country, that her work was, quote, below the dignity of criticism, that it wasn't even worth engaging with. So we can't even take it seriously because Black people don't possess this sort of artistic and emotional acumen with which to create art. And so this can't be called poetry because Black people they can't experience love. They can only experiencing the sort of kindling of imagination, and thus they can't create this work. But like, what does that feel like? And what does it feel like for me, right? And one of the things that I talk about in this book is that, like, if Anis went to all these places that I went, if Hanif went to all of these places I went, if anyone else went to these same places, they might have different experiences, right? I always think about that Alfred Lord Tennyson Ulysses poem where he says, "I am a part of all that I have met," mm-hmm. right? And like that's all of us, right? Like we bring all of our experiences, all of our identities, all of our conversations, all of our politics, all of our sensibilities to every place and every interaction we have. And that, you know, so my book is not at all a definitive account of any of these places. They are meant to be reflections of like one person's experience at one moment in time at any of these given places that are, you know, fundamentally shaped by who I am. And I think that that's what I hope, you know, and am interested in hearing is like how other people who have been to these places have experienced them, right? Is it similar to the way I've experienced them? Is it different? How much of that shape is that shaped by me being Black? What would somebody, you know, in a lot of these places, I was one of the only Black people on these tours or one of the only Black people on this land. And I thought often about would the discourse and language being used here be different if I was a white person, right? Like, is something being held back? Is something being framed differently? Is something being hedged? So all that's to say, I take seriously the idea that Black people are not singularly defined by enslavement in this country. Our history is so much more vast, so much more robust, and is not at all defined by our experience in chains. I also think that we can't completely push it away, or that we can't ignore the very real ways that has shaped our country, that the enslavement in this country existed in, or at least what would become this country, for 100 years longer than it hasn't, right? So like, if this isn't a thing that we can just be like, you know, we're not defined by slavery, so we shouldn't talk about it anymore. And even when I understand that impulse, I said, it's not a mutually exclusive thing, right? You have to have folks who are riding into spaces that are not defined by trauma. But also I think there's a way to write in about enslavement that is not singularly defined by trauma, right? Like you take seriously the cruelty, the barbarity of the institution, but also recognize the ways that enslaved people created moments of centered their personhood was centered for themselves all the time, right? And that we created an entire culture that would shape the world in these unfathomable conditions. And like, how remarkable is that, you know? And so yes. I think just centering the personhood and humanity of the enslaved, but taking seriously the sort of larger realities and not running from that is important. And it's a balancing act like anything else, you know? And so that's why I think we need a range of work across the range of experiences, as Hanif said, that like Black folks aren't homogenous and we're a deeply pluralistic group of folks and become even more so across every generation. And though all of those experiences deserve to be written about and deserve a rich, robust literary and historical treatment.
And I think it's just a correction of the historical record because of America's just eagerness to, not even an eagerness to forget, which is very real, but an eagerness to lie their way towards, you know, like, I don't know what it was. I'm on Twitter much less these days, but I guess Pete Buttigieg, he'd made a very correct comment that the history of American freeways is racist, right?
Yeah.
And there were like these Republican organizations tweeting like, can you believe that he said this? Can you believe that this is a joke? And it's wild because that's actually just history. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's not even like difficult to find history.
It's not hard to find that information out.
But like the function of these places and the function of the institutions are to present history, racist history, as preposterous, right?
And because, to turn it into an ideological statement rather than a rhetorical one, right?
Right. Same thing where
you say that, like, the Southern flag, when somebody's like, the Southern flag was about heritage, and you're like, well, no, it was about a treasonous army who fought a war predicated on maintaining and expanding the institution of slavery. And you're like, why are you trying to indoctrinate people with your politics? And it's like, that's just what it was. Like,
it's just true.
It just happened. You know, but I think that's like so much of the American machinery relies on these kind of manipulations of fact. Mm-hmm. To make people then end up at the end result where it's like, well, everything's about race. And it's like, I mean, listen, this country was founded on violence and then was built in large part by enslaved folks. And so if everything sprouts from, say, and I, you know, it's so funny that I live in obviously Columbus, Ohio, which was named after violent colonizer Christopher Columbus. And they just took down this past summer. They took down two of the three Christopher Columbus statues. There's still a tiny one hanging around. And when the big one in front of City Hall came down, and the mayor was like, you know, maybe we should take this down because, you know, Christopher Columbus, not that great of a guy. There were people who was like, well, why is this all about race? Why is it all? It's like, listen, man, yeah, y'all gotta start coming to terms with the history of the country because. It is what it is. Like there's no, and I'm not too enamored with the American project, but let's say that you are someone who just loves being an American, right? What is more useful than a critical love that engages with history and not a passive love that pretends that everything you love is infallible? You know, people deride stan culture in the way like music stans behave online, but there's a really short bridge between that in the kind of indoctrination of American affection that is, it's the same thing, right? Where it's like,
definitely
nothing I love can be, everything I love is infallible. And I will say like stan culture didn't come out of nowhere. That was forged in the fires of American machinery, which says and pushes this idea that everything one loves must be infallible or else love is unattainable, unachievable.
There's a part in your book, Clint, where you're talking about, I think it's like maybe like when you're in conversation at, is it the Blanford Cemetery? Some of the folks that are there for like the Son of Confederates, which like I'm reading that channel, like this feels like some kind of like surreal version of like a Borat scene because it's like true and legit. And I was like, man, I'm just like stupefied at some points where I'm just like, go Clint, man. Just like, all right, I'm going to be here. I'm going to talk to these folks. Like, awesome. But like, I think it's in that somewhere in there, you're speaking to how, you know, that disconnect. One of the guys that you're speaking with, he's talking about how like that the purpose of the Civil War, its point was for freedom, you know? And that like, that it's not about slavery. It's about like all the states being able to have the freedom to do whatever it is that they personally want to do. And, you know, that there's just like this kind of like ignoring or unrealization or disconnect of that, like in saying that you support freedom, you are also only saying then in this situation that you only support one kind of freedom because there are millions of other people whose freedom is disenfranchised by giving this freedom to continue to engage with slavery as an economic means. And, you know, you speak to how individuals not being able to reckon with that the possibility and the feasibility that their great-great-grandfather, their great-great-great-grandfather and grandmother did like horrible things that were monsters. And, you know, I think that it's like a chicken versus the egg thing where it's like, I don't know if like so much of like how we engage in our current culture is as a result of that or like we don't reckon with that because of like some other thing that we are in right now. And, you know, I think a lot about that aspect, you know, as Hanif was speaking about like how trying to sit in the same space as all that is like horrible. And if you mentioned about the American project, even while not being a thing that one is like, yo, I do not ride for this thing here. You know, like this is super, super troubling and problematic. But like separate of like it being American, you know, this idea that if one loves something, in order to like love it more fully and to be more fully loved by it, you also have to like make space for all that which is like not holy, all that which is not pretty. You know, like that in order to fully engage with the heart, you know, one has to like recognize, like, if I'm going to do that, then I have to be vulnerable enough that there will be pain, that there will be suffering, that there will be things revealed to me that I don't know what to make of. And that like too much in our country and our culture, I think, really has no idea how to like engage with these ideas of grief and loss and anger and pain. Because they're so afraid of what that means, when the reality is that like those things, if we engage with them, they're like rooting for us. You know, they're like, yo, like we want you to be full. You know, we want you to have that love. You know, like I'm grief and I love you. I'm anger and I love you, you know? Yeah. And it's like, it's honestly super painful for me personally, to the thought of the amount of people that like cannot hold that which is like painful, with the recognizing that like if I hold this painful thing, I can grow in such beautiful ways, you know?
And I think so many people's sense of history is a story they tell themselves, right? And in that story, entwined within that story is people's sense of their own lineage, right? And so when we think about the American project, the way that people conceptualize what that is deeply entangled in their own family history. And so in the piece that you're referring to in that chapter, Anise is, you know, the guy's like, well, if you're asking me to accept that my grandfather or my great-grandfather and my great-great-grandfather were monsters. And implicit within that is that, like, I can't accept that, right? Like, I won't accept that, because what does that say about my grandfather and my father and me and my children?
Exactly.
You are if I accept the implication of my ancestors, it implicates me and implicates my sense of who I am in this country. And I can't accept that. And it was, you know, for me, it's like, well, what does it look like to reckon with the fact that your ancestors I can't speak to their personhood, right? But I can speak to their actions. I can recognize that it is important for us to think about what it meant for your great-great-grandfather to have fought for a monstrous cause, for a barbarous cause whose implications directly impacted my ancestors, right? And like what their status in this country would be. And the other point you were making, this guy, Jeff, in the chapter, he was like, you know, if the Northern states had just stayed where they are, nothing would have happened and everything would have been fine. And I'm like, fine for who? Right? Like,
exactly.
Like, not fine for the 4 million enslaved Black folks, right? But like, but that's how they're thinking of it, right? And it's like, history for whom? Who is included in even the sort of historical memory that people are using to orient how they move through the world? And it was, you know, we see an iteration of this now in our political system, especially over the last 5 years, where like, it's just this in huge political and what will be sort of historical gaslighting, where people try to tell you that something you saw isn't what you saw, which is exactly what the Confederates did after the Civil War, right? Like, they were like, this wasn't about slavery. And everybody's like, wait, but in 1861, when you seceded from the Union, you wrote on paper that everybody could see, we are leaving because we want to keep our slaves, right? We're like, but like that, and it was successful, right? Like, that's the thing. That's the insidiousness of this country's history, is that they were like, They seceded from the Union, and because they said, like a state like Mississippi said, our interests are thoroughly aligned with the institution of slavery, the greatest material interests in the world. Right, like, so they said it. They were not vague about why they were leaving the Union. They thought Abraham Lincoln was elected in 1860 and that he was going to take away their enslaved workers. And so it was time for them to bounce. And then after the war, you got Alexander Stevens, vice president of the Confederacy, and Jefferson Davis, president of the Confederacy, and all these other folks who were like, no. This wasn't about slavery. You're mistaken. That we never said anything like that. And it's like you said, it's the same thing with January 6th. People are like, there was no violence. We're like, what are you talking? We all watched the video. But like, this is what happens over and over and over again. And unfortunately, there's a huge precedent for being successful and distort, and not even successful in necessarily convincing people, but in this sort of Orwellian distortion of the facts that people have, right? So where you have people who are moving through the world with fundamentally different sets of knowledge and facts about what they think is true.
Well, you know, like on both like large ways and small ways, like that it's always present. You know, at the start of our conversation, like you mentioned the Robert E. Lee statue, you know, and it's like, you know, I remember as a boy, like we'd leave downtown and to drive back home. And, you know, we almost always like went by way of the Robert E. Lee statue. That was just like the route. And, you know, remember at a young age, not really like having any type of concept or idea of who this person was. His name was everywhere. You know, there was an elementary school named after him, six blocks from my house, you know? All I knew was that there was like this statue that like sat in like the middle of an empty space, like this huge roundabout. And there was just like this column that was taller than any other building right there. And there was a bright light against this black background of this, you know, white statue of this white guy named Robert E. Lee. And it looked magical to me, you know? And so it's like, it also then works on these really small ways in order to chip away at this like bigger feeling, you know, that it's like, oh, Robert E. Lee, the person that he was is like removed from the thoughts then. It's just like, oh, there's this beautiful, wonderful statue that always kind of like struck one with wonder when you went past it without like holding with it the weight of like what it actually stood for and what it was doing on a day-to-day basis.
Well, a part of that too is, I mean, so much of the reaction to statues being taken down has less to do with the history of the person and more to do with the actual structure itself, right? Which is also very prevalent in America, I think, where it's like beauty. You know, it's so funny. The poet Terence Hayes, of course, says this sometimes, though this is not what his intention is, but he sometimes says like beauty over truth in the work, right? If you're a poet writing, you know, if you can ascribe some beauty to the truth, perhaps in sacrifice some truth in ascribing that beauty, that serves the work. But that is used much more nefariously in the context that we're talking about, where so many people value aesthetics over honest reconciliation of where we are, where we can go.
Mm-hmm. And I think that part of what happens too is that even those who defend keeping the statues there for aesthetic reasons or for reasons that are afraid of like precedent or like, well, what does it mean if we take this one down? What are we going to take all of them down? Or who's, I mean, and honest, and this, it's a fascinating point, Anise, because like, I too remember, I mean, I went to City Park. We went to City Park all the time, right? Like, and to get into City Park, you ride by a statue of P.G.T. Beauregard on horseback. And P.G.T. Beauregard is the general who ordered the first shot that opened the Civil War. And so I'm literally this black child feeding the geese and feeding the ducks under the shadow of a statue of this man who in essence began the war that was fighting to maintain and expand the bondage that my ancestors were held in. But it is also this like just if you, to the extent that one can like remove themselves from the history, this like striking and compelling statue that like is creates this like very, again, if you're removed from the history, a sort of like aesthetically appealing feeling as you enter the park that's lined with these oak trees and the Spanish moss and this horse that looks like it's jumping into the air, and you're like, wow, look at this. It kind of creates a majestic feeling to it. And I think for a lot of folks in New Orleans, you know, people I've had conversations with, that something like that is so deeply ingrained in their sense of the city, right? And their sense, so almost it's to Hanif's point, where like it almost becomes less about the history and like more like you are removing these aesthetics that are tied to how I have come of age in this place and understood myself in relation to this place, you know?
And like redefining what it means to be from a place too. Like what it means to be from anywhere, I think is important.
Yeah.
Was there anything for both of you that like, you know, in writing the book that you were surprised to find blooming in you, you know, as a result of moving through the work of both these books?
I mean, I think for me, this was the first book I wrote that I felt good writing. I felt excited writing, and I felt eager to return to, and I didn't feel like it was at all anguished. And I felt sad to let it go in a way, you know. I felt sad that it was no longer just mine, though I'm of course thankful that it's now in the world. And I think that's just because of how visual the research experience was. A lot of videos and a lot of photo archives that just brought me a lot of pleasure. You know, there's like on YouTube, you can watch 50 years worth of Josephine Baker performances. You know, there's videos of her performances in 1925 up to the mid-1970s. And that's just, to kind of sit in the stunning nature of that by itself was so propelling and propulsive for me, you know, that I can watch eras of LaBelle on YouTube, that there's just a massive, I mean, I had a massive archive of Soul Train videos sent to me. Mm-hmm. And so like these kind of things where, and to watch those Soul Train videos chronologically is, you know, I had a hard drive of every episode from like 1971 to 1989. And to watch them chronologically, you just see an evolution of Black hair, Black fashion, Black dance, Black politics. And to get to marvel at that kind of thing was really brought me a lot of pleasure.
Yeah, I mean, I similarly really enjoyed the research aspect of the project. And one of the things that I liked about this kind of book is that I actually had no idea where it would take me. You know, like I was subject to the whims of the people that I met at a place. And like, you know, sometimes I would go to a place thinking I would write about that place, and then it would lead me to another place that I actually wrote about, right? So for example, I never had any intention of going to the Blanford Cemetery, and certainly had never, didn't have any intention of like spending the day with the Sons of Confederate Veterans. But I went to a Civil War battlefield in Virginia because I thought I was going to write this chapter on like Civil War battlefields and how we remember those. And then after that tour was somebody told me, they were like, oh, because I was telling the tour guide about my project. He was like, oh, you should go to this place, Blanford Cemetery. It's like 15 minutes down the road. And I was like, Blanford Cemetery. And I was like, I don't know if I have time. I got to get home to give the kids a bath. It was all sort of stuff. But he was like, go check it out. And I went. And I went, like, I showed up there. And as you know, because you've read the book, but like, I go there and I get the tour of this church in which, you know, this strange sort of experience of cognitive dissonance where you're getting a tour of this church that was built to honor the memory of fallen Confederate soldiers. And they have these beautiful stained glass windows. And the entire tour is like talking about the history and beauty of these windows and not at all talking about the reason that these windows were built. Even though the inscription on the bottom of the windows says like, for those who fought for the Confederate, like in honor of those who fought for the Confederacy, and just to have an hour long tour in which that's not mentioned at all. And then I go into the,
unbelievable.
It's wild. And, but it's a microcosm of what happens at so many of these plantations, at these sites. But I go into the visitor center, and on the counter, I see a flyer for the Sons of Confederate Veterans Memorial Day celebration. And the person behind the counter like flips the over the paper and puts her hand over it. And I was like, okay, well, I know where I need to go next, right? And so I say that to say that I liked this book really took me on a journey, and I really didn't know after each place, I didn't know. I went to a place not knowing what I would see, not knowing what I would experience. You know, you write your nonfiction, your book proposal, and you're like, this is what I'm gonna do, and these are the places I'm gonna go. And then you quickly start doing it, and you're like, oh, this project is taking me in a very different direction than I anticipated it would. And I think for Hanif, in a different way, it's similar, right? Like, if I think for any of these extended nonfiction projects, you think you go in having an idea what you think you're gonna write about, and then the research, whether it's, you know, YouTube videos, or whether it's like conversations with folks in these places, it takes you in a different direction, but in the direction you're supposed to go.
I suppose we'll end on that note. Thank y'all so much.
That was a conversation with Oregon Poet Laureate Anees Majgani, Clint Smith, and Hanif Abdurraqib. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project is provided by Cole Haan, on a mission to fuel your big ideas. More at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast, with production oversight by Amanda Bullock and support from Liz Olofsson. Special thanks to Joe T. Roy and the entire Literary Arts staff, board, and community. The show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another episode of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.